This is Phil Ferrand.
And I am driving home. I couldn't get the key in the lock. It just seems like an enormous amount of time when you're sitting there going, and you can't get the key into the ignition. But in fact, it's just moments. But I pushed it in a little wrong, and then I was pushing, and nothing was happening. Anyways, it's been a good week. It's Thursday today. It is episode 546. So it's not going to be too long before we hit 550. And it actually won't be very long until we are at 11 years worth of podcasts. And let's see, 11 years worth of podcasts will be at 572. So we are at 546. So close to halfway? Maybe. I don't know. So things are puttering along. The writing is good. I finished my first read through, and that's always exciting because when you're just plowing and making edits as you're going, you know, that when you actually read through the book back to back, you get a much better sense of pacing. I did cut out some stuff and kind of honed that down a little bit. Probably could have cut out more stuff. I have a tendency to be verbose, but that's okay. The pacing seems to be okay. And good news is the epilogue seems to be okay, which is really kind of the, you know, got to ring the bell with the epilogue there. So that seems to be fine. Introducing a lot of interesting things. The book is called An Unexpected Hour. So there should be things that are unexpected if the book is going to be called An Unexpected Hour. And I think there are. So we're good there. Everything's puttering along at work. We're still doing our sprint methodology, and that seems to be working good. We're settling in there. It is Uncle Sam Day tomorrow, so that should be fun. I did this past week kind of do a trial run on the Uncle Sam costume. It was last week. Maybe I talked about that last week, so maybe that's not important. I know what else we did this week, but I don't know if I should talk about that. My daughter actually helped me out with this costume a little bit. I can't remember what I talked about last week. It's not important. My daughter helped me a little bit, and went down Saturday morning, so we jabbered a little bit while she was helping me with that, running kids around and doing all that kind of stuff, so that was fun. So I think I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that my computer, my USB ports had just stopped, completely stopped. I actually had a friend, a fellow coworker, look at it. He ran it through his paces and he said, you know, normally, he said, I have a USB stick that has Linux on it. So if I'm looking for some kind of a hardware problem, I just stick that thing on, boot it up, have it boot off that stick. And then I can tell, he said, but there's no USB ports on this thing. So he said, that didn't work. So he said, I actually put a hard drive in it that had Linux on it, and it came up and the USB port still didn't work, so apparently it is some type of a hardware issue. It's really weird. Some type of a hardware issue that apparently went bad at the same time that I got a Windows update in, which is, you know, coincidences, but those things happen. I mean, I don't reboot that machine much, so you know, that machine could have been on for I don't know how long. And when the Windows update came through, it rebooted the machine, and then the machine shut down and yada yada. So anyways, but he did figure out that the PS2 ports still work. So now I have a backup. When I do the cover, if I need a backup, I have a backup. and I do have network on it, so I think, so I've ordered a PS2 keyboard and mouse. We'll get those hooked up when I get home because they came in from Amazon. And with those, if I need to use the desktop to design a cover, I can. I'm going to try to do it with my laptop, but we'll see. We'll see. I don't have hardware graphics acceleration on that laptop, so we'll see. But I'm hoping, I'm doing the Grammarly edit right now, and so I'm hoping sometime this weekend to start the cover. And then once I get the base of the cover built, then I can take pictures of the grandkids. I think I've got all their costumes in at this point. So we're going to try those on this evening, see how they fit. And if that all is good, then we'll go from there. So I think book 11's all coming together. It's all pieces are moving, and I think it's going to be fine. I think it's going to be fine. So that's that. Small point of interest. We apparently did have an earthquake in Mountain. I didn't look this up, so I may have this wrong. Mountain Home, Arkansas, I think. There is a, the New Madrid Fault does run along the eastern side of the state, and there, of Missouri, and there has always been a question about when the New Madrid Fault goes, because it has gone in the past. It has gone fairly violently in the past. I think the story is that when it went violently in the past, it actually caused the Mississippi River to flow backwards for 3 days. So that's fairly significant. And there has been some question, since it's all ground between here and there, that if the New Madrid Fault would go, would we even feel it here? Or are there enough caves that it would break up? But my wife reported that last night when she was working, in the wee hours of the morning, as she is wont to do, when she was working, she said all of a sudden, she said it was like some big animal was running across the rafters of our ceilings. And she said, oh, what is going on? Has a raccoon gotten up there? She didn't know because it was vibrating the kitchen cabinets. And the doors were kind of vibrating. And then she said, I got on Google and started looking around. And sure enough, there had been a 3.4, I think she said, magnitude earthquake in Mountain Home. And it's interesting, Mountain Home, if I remember right, is about halfway between us and the edge of the state. And if a 3.4 was enough to rattle our doors, makes you wonder what a 6 or a 7 at the New Madrid Fault would do. So we'll see. So who knew? Who knew that we might have to be concerned about earthquakes here in Springfield, Missouri? I can't imagine that it would be devastating. I was in the Philippines, in Manila, during a 6.7 that lasted for 30 seconds. We weren't right on the epicenter of that earthquake, but we were somewhat close. That earthquake did a significant amount of damage farther into town. There was a building had been built poorly. I think it was an apartment complex. And the earthquake popped out the walls on this, I think it was a 13-story or 15-story apartment complex. Popped out the walls and just pancaked the floors. I mean, it was bad. But our house, I remember having a dream while it was going on, but our house was just fine. And our bedroom, where my brother and I slept, it was actually on concrete stilts that were above the family car. So, you know, that that could have been a problem. If we had crushed the car and punctured the gas tank and gotten a spark, and things could have been a little interesting there. But, you know, it didn't, and all was well. So we'll see. We'll see. It's interesting. It's just, I hadn't been in an earthquake for a long time. We used to get them in the Philippines all the time. And so it brought back a lot of memories when my beloved was talking about the fact that she'd been sitting there when the earthquake was going. I don't know if she's ever been in an earthquake before. I'll have to ask her that when we get home. Anyways, I came across an article, and I think I have mentioned this in the past because I was vaguely aware of the studies and the essence of this article. I have been for a while, but I couldn't remember if I had actually done a podcast on this. And I thought, you know, this is an interesting thing because we tell ourselves certain stories about fame and about people who make it to the top of their hierarchies based on popularity, not necessarily based on accomplishments, but based on popularity and based on accomplishments of a more subjective type. One of the things that's interesting about the arts is that sometimes in dealing with the arts, we struggle because there is not an objective standard by which we can say something is good. So one of the big surprises to me as I was paying more attention to what things sell in terms of books, because that was of interest to me, because I was writing books and there was a time when I was concerned about how books sold because that was my livelihood. And at that time, I read The Celestine Prophecy because it had sold 5 million copies, and I thought, well, I should read this to see if I can figure out why this thing is so popular. And I remember reading it and thinking, this is terrible. I mean, honestly, my 12-year-old daughter at the time, who she just turned 37, so this was 25 years ago, my 12-year-old daughter at the time could have written that book and probably done a better job just from my evaluation of what is quality writing. But that's just my evaluation. It's subjective. And so when we have artistic expressions and we're trying to come up with an evaluation of it, there's all kinds of these different rules that may or may not be valid. For instance, I often use the phrase, in addition. Well, in addition to this, blah, 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 in addition to that. I'm going through Grammarly now, having it look at book 11. It doesn't like in addition. It would rather have it say also or something like that. It's just in addition's too wordy. Well, I happen to like how in addition sounds. So, you know, they have a rule slash suggestion that sometimes I'll pay attention to and sometimes I won't because it's subjective. A lot of times, in order to try to resolve the subjectivity of these things, one of the ways people judge art and artful expressions is, well, how many copies has it sold? As if commercialization of art then somehow proves its value, which is a proposition that I absolutely am opposed to. because the crowd, the mass, is not really good at judging the quality of something, as this article demonstrates. Fame is not a good standard either to just say, oh, well, it's famous, so it must be good. Because it is very interesting. And in this, the name of the article was Homo Naravitus and the Trouble with Fame. And so the author of the article starts out by saying, our understanding of fame is critical to how we see each other and our society, but it is also badly wrong. We humans are storytelling and story-finding machines, Homo Naravitus, if you will, Narrativus, if you will. In making sense of the world, we look for shapes of meaningful narratives in everything. Even in science, we enjoy mathematical equations and algorithms because they are a kind of universal story. Fluids, the oceans and the atmospheres, the blood in your body, honey, all flow according to a single beautiful set of equations called the Navier-Stokes equations, etc., etc. And he goes on to illustrate by saying that whenever, like, there's a news story, it usually gets down to an individual pretty quickly. They have some individual that's given as the example of this person who is experiencing this story. So, for instance, one article in the New York Times on Hurricane Sandy discussed the unproven fact that more babies are generated when generators fail. And it opened with the lines, last October, Hurricane Sandy pumped 6 feet of water into the lobby of a residential building in downtown New Jersey, trapping Megan B. Murphy with her husband Patrick in their apartment and leaving them with electricity for days. So immediately, you know, this, then the story winds its way down, not into a set of gross statistics, but immediately winds down to individuals and the experience of the individual. Because we relate to the experience of an individual. We have an empathic response to the experience of an individual. But one of the troubles with that is that, according to this man, if you combine this compulsion to tell stories and our bias towards the individual, we tend to form up these narratives that equate a person's place to other properties. So specifically, he says, they cause us to believe that fame is earned. That is a result. Fame is earned. That it is a result of intrinsic properties of the famous person or object. If it's famous, there must be a reason that it's famous. And that reason has to be bound up in the properties of that thing. And this is interesting, because he said, consider, for example, the Mona Lisa, perhaps the most famous painting in the world. Its fame is ascribed to all manner of intrinsic qualities. The subject's mysterious smile, her unchangeable expression, the way her eyes follow you, Da Vinci's novel use of sfumato, S-M-U-M-A-T-O, sfumato. I don't know what that is. The individual genius of Leonardo himself. Oh, hey, say, just a second. I'm getting the shower unit replaced down at the little rock house because we needed to do it. And then they found out the floor was not good, and my buddy is here and he's helping put in a floor, so I'm just gonna drop in and see him real quick. I'm gonna put this on pause and then I'll be right back. Okay, I'm back. So anyways, they were pulling out the tub Because I don't have a renter in the Rock House right now, and we're ramping up for some people to move in, but it had been a while, and that tub shower unit had gotten kind of grody, and so we're just going ahead and replacing that. Of course, they pulled it out, and the floor was rotten, so and I had another guy come in, and so he's putting a new floor in for me, so then we put the tub shower unit back in, blah, 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 blah. All the exciting things. But the Mona Lisa, oh, one moment, I've got to get my mail here, just a second. So, you know, you hear about the Mona Lisa, and you see the pictures of the Mona Lisa, and you hear about it, and you see the pictures, and you think, wow, you know, this thing must be the most fabulous thing ever. And, you know, it must be inevitable, just inevitable that it was going to be famous, because this, that, and the other, and blah, 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 blah. But what's interesting is that, I'm getting my mail, by the way. What's interesting is that when people see it in person, it's a different experience. Because he says, if we travel to the Louvre, we find ourselves bemused immediately by the surprising smallness of the Mona Lisa. It's only 30 inches by 21 inches. It's basically 2 foot by 3 foot. Pretty small. We observe that museum goers pause for a few moments at most in front of the painting. And we wonder if this is really the best that we can do. This is the best painting in the world. As Dr. Sassoon lays out in his book, Becoming Mona Lisa, Leonardo's now great painting took 400 years to become world-renowned and jumped to fame only after being stolen and later vandalized, certainly not events dictated by some intrinsic quality. Okay, So how do we determine the mechanisms of fame then? How would we go about this? Well, I'd heard of this experiment that the author of this article had run back in 2006 that was pretty interesting. And it was called Music Lab One. They had roughly 14,000 internet participants and gave them a total of 48 songs by unknown artists to listen to, rate, and download. What we didn't tell them was that they were randomly assigned to 9 separate worlds. One world in which participants acted independently of each other, and 8 parallel social worlds in which participants saw the current number of downloads of each song within their world, an indication of popularity. So what's interesting is that in the independent world that served as the control to the other 8 social worlds, the popularity of the songs in this world reflected the intrinsic quality of the songs. There were a few songs that did poorly in this world, plus all 8 social worlds, and others that performed reliably well. Things were much different in the social worlds. Here, rankings were much more affected primarily by chance and the choices made by early participants. One song, for example, ranked first in one world and 40th in another. What's more, we were able to influence the song's ranking by tweaking the strength of the social signal in each world. Through varying whether the songs were randomly arranged in a jukebox format or in the order of number of previous downloads, the experiment clearly showed that people like to imitate each other. And even weak social signaling skewed the popularity distributions significantly. So that's pretty interesting. So you got these 40 songs and they're spread out among all these groups. If the popularity of the song was based on an intrinsic quality within the song, you would think that all songs that were quote unquote good songs would rise at the same time. But in fact, that's not the truth. and something that's wildly popular like Celestine Prophecy was may not be based on so much on the quality of the work so much as someone read it and they thought, well, this is pretty cool, and they told a friend, and they told a friend, and they told a friend. When there were a bunch of other books out there that were probably on the same subject matter, but they didn't get that type of bounce. And there is one other thing in here that is pretty interesting. Well, a couple of things. He said, when we're thinking about fame and how it works, he said, one way that we can see the fallacy of believing that fame is intrinsic to the value of that thing that is becoming famous is to create an analogy and write a bit, as he calls it, of Pulp Fiction about this analogy. So here's his little paragraph of Pulp Fiction. When a matchbox full of lazily dreaming future grill lighters was brought to a small town store on a hot summer day in the California desert, little did it know that one of its passengers would become the most notorious, most sought-after weapon of all time. 2 weeks later, one of its matches would be used to start a wildfire that would burn for months and destroy 50 million acres. Anyone armed with such a match like this one would be able to take over the world. Now, obviously, you do need a match. You do need a spark to get a fire going, but how far that fire spreads and where that fire ends up going, of course, has more to do than just the match. It has to do with the kindling, it has to do with the environment, all those things. And that's really the key of what he's talking about in this article, that fame is kind of like that fire, and you not only have to have something to get it going for people to talk about, then it has to be able to spread to others as well. And one of the interesting things about this is that because of this mimicry we engage in, because we like to imitate others, because we like to see, they like that, so that must be good. There's kind of a counterintuitive thing that happens when they look at the number of friends that a person has and how much influence they have over those friends. And that was pretty interesting because when they started looking into this social contagion phenomenon, the assumption is that the more friends a person has, the faster the contagion would spread. But they don't think that that's necessarily true. They've done experiments and they've said, for more complicated model networks where our mathematical analysis comes up short, the author and his coworker have studied social contagion and influence through simulation. And they found that, in fact, people with a mid-level of friends seem to be better at spreading these social contagions than people with more friends. And if I read the article correctly, the difference there is that when you have more friends or a certain level of friends, no matter what you like or suggest or us liking, there will always be some people say, well, I didn't like that. You know, whereas if you have less friends, the chances are you may have the majority of people saying, yeah, well, that was pretty good. Or at least there's more people, if you have a smaller number of friends, that are more likely to agree with you, and that causes the contagion to spread faster. So that's pretty interesting. You know, for me, what this all comes down to is what I've told people in the past is if you look at somebody like a Justin Bieber and you think to yourself, oh, Justin Bieber, he's just so talented. He was always meant and destined to be a rock, you know, world pop star, blah, 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 because just look back. And when he was a little kid, he was drumming on chairs and look at that. And he was so dedicated that, you know, his dreams. And if you hear Justin Bieber, I think he was the one that was talking about in his biography. A lot of people do. So maybe it's autobiography about just keep believing your dreams and just keep working hard, because if you do all that stuff, something will eventually happen. Yeah, well that's the story we tell. It's the same thing when authors who have a breakout book are asked by reporters, now, when you were writing this, did you ever imagine that it would go this big? Well, of course, every author imagines that their books are going to go big. Of course they do. But by asking that question, and then when the author says, yes, I always knew this was going to be a, you know, big hit, then we give the impression that if you think your work is going to be a big hit, then it is going to be a big hit. But in fact, fame is attributable to more chance than that. There's a whole lot of things that got to go right. Which is why I tell people you should just write for the enjoyment of writing. You should just write for the joy of doing it. Don't worry about how many books you sell. But it's very interesting then when you look at somebody like a Justin Bieber that you think, oh, well, he was destined for greatness. But in fact, Scooter Braun, I think was his agent, just happened to stumble onto a YouTube video of Justin Bieber. And Scooter Braun just pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed him. You know, radio stations wouldn't play his stuff because he was too young. And so they actually drove Justin Bieber and flew Justin Bieber around to all these radio stations to do the interviews, to get his music played. And they pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. So it wasn't so much the music per se. It was the pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. And eventually, you know, you reach critical mass and something catches and it goes from there. And Justin Bieber happened to come up right about the same time that social media was coming up. I was listening to a thing on Elvis, and they were talking about how Elvis was coming up right around the same time that television was coming up. And so Elvis was really that kind of that first huge, huge famous rock star guy because that vehicle was there for him. Was Elvis more talented than all his contemporaries? No. Was Justin Bieber more talented than all his contemporaries? No. You know, he just hit a social contagion where this person talked to that person, talked to that person, talked to that person. And frankly, I may have mentioned this before, one of the things that is an interesting little side experiment that I'm doing with this series of 24 books is I'm seeing if I can create a story. Not the story that is in the books, but the story about the books. The fact that it's 24 books written in 12 years. Is there a story there that this guy worked, you know, an almost full-time job, and then in the evenings, over 12 years, he created 24 books, which I haven't yet. I'm on book 11. 24 books that will probably be 10,000 pages of novel and will probably be somewhere around 3.5 million words. Is there enough of a story there that people start talking about it enough to make other people interested? Is there enough of a story that I can just sit in my basement and have a couple of dozen beta readers, and that's all. And it'll be enough to catch and go. It's going to be interesting to see. I mean, I have noticed that I have more, seemingly more people, when I tell people, yeah, I'm on book 11 now and stuff, I've seemingly more people say, well, you know, I've been looking for something to read, so where can I find those? Hey, Amazon.com. Just look for Farrand, F-A-R-R-A-N-D, Windfall. Kindle versions, print versions, whatever you want. Now, whether people follow on and actually read, I don't know, but I've kind of noticed an uptick now that I'm close to halfway through with this series. Noticed a bit of an uptick of people showing an interest. So we'll see if that's just an anomaly and everything goes back to the way it was, or whether or not things keep spreading. It's really fascinating. Doesn't matter to me whether they do or not. I'm going to keep writing because I love writing. I love this story. I love telling this story. It's fun. But I think we would be well to understand that when we race to assign value simply because something is popular or famous, we can often be in error. That there were plenty of things at the time that was happening that were of the same quality but never achieved liftoff. So it's just very, very interesting. So I think this just reinforces to me the advantage of not worrying about how things sell, but simply to continue on doing the creative work for the joy and the wonder and the value that it brings me as an individual. And as I'm fond of saying, I encourage everybody to find an epic, find an adventure, find something that is creative that you can call your own. That thing that if you do not do it, there will be a gap in the world. This is Phil Farrand, and I have made it home.